session number 4816, Reel 6.
Commander Moran, Reel 6. I wonder if you could tell me, Commander Moran, something about the problems that were created for the POWs in Kolditz through being incarcerated in a castle rather than the normal type of German lager.
Problems. Looking back on it, I don't see any problems whatsoever. But casting my mind back to the time, particularly when I first arrived at Kolditz during my first few days there, I think the two problems really that hit me in the eye. One was how closely confined we were, not only in our living quarters but also in our exercise quarters, the space around us, because all we had was that fiddling little bloody courtyard, which was, I suppose, not much bigger than a tennis court. It couldn't have been. If you envisage a tennis court with its normal surround, no bigger than that, if as big. And there at times you had anything up to, well, before the French and the Belgians and so on and the Poles left, we had perhaps anything up to 350 chaps. And this was their sole exercise space. And so, of course, everything went on in there, you know, walking, or on the rare occasions in the summer when you got some sun, because you only got sun when the sun was overhead. So from the point of view of getting some sun, from the point of view of playing games, from the point of view of just walking around, everything was very, very crowded indeed. This was one point that struck me almost immediately. The other was that the guards were there with you all the time. There were at least two guards on duty all the time in the courtyard. They were with you. At Marlegg, for example, you very rarely saw the guards. Occasionally you'd see one drifting around, perhaps with his dog snooping around, or you had the guards who used to pay chummy visits to the various rooms. But insofar as Kolditz was concerned, the guards were there with their rifles slung over their shoulders, and they obviously had very, very strict orders, not only, of course, to keep an eye on us, to see that nothing illegal was going on, but also not to get chummy with us. I mean, you just couldn't get chummy with the guards in Kolditz, except, of course, there were one or two chaps who had that gift of getting chummy with them. Yes, these were my first impressions of Kolditz, but the second impression, and this occurred very, very quickly indeed, whereas in previous camps, particularly at Marlegg, the chap who wanted to escape was the odd man out, one soon learnt in Kolditz that if one didn't want to escape, one was the odd man out. This was it. So one felt a compulsion to find some way of getting out, to look around. One found a compulsion of being one of the chaps there. One had to adopt a different approach altogether. Whereas in Marlegg, one, I suppose, virtually had to excuse oneself for digging tunnels or for making a nuisance of oneself, and that's how it was thought of there. In Kolditz, if one wasn't engaged in some escape activity, even if one knew right from the beginning that, no, it was just a waste of bloody time, it would be abortive, it would get you nowhere, even if one knew that, one had to present oneself to the rest of the chaps as being that sort of chap, you see. So that was a bit. I remember one occasion in particular, and this was in a sort of alcove leading up to the Saal House. And I spent weeks and weeks and weeks there on the entrance to a tunnel. I knew it would bloody well get us nowhere. I couldn't, well, maybe I was wrong, but this was my impression. I couldn't see that it was getting anywhere, but one felt that one had to do this. Because
what's a Saal House?
Well, that's just what it was called, the Saalhaus. And this is where the senior officers lived, the senior prisoners of war, that is, majors and above, lieutenant commanders and above, squadron leaders and above lived there. Their quarters were there. They had no privileges over and above ours, but the Germans have a strict sense of rank, always have had, and they were regarded as senior officers, and their living quarters were separate from ours, leading off the courtyard in the same way, but they were in different rooms from us. That was known as the Saalhaus. That was the old name for it. What its meaning is, I just don't know, but that's it. So this was one occasion when I was deeply involved in an escape attempt, which I knew would get us nowhere. The only one that I remember being deeply involved in that showed a remote chance of success, and very few of the ideas of escaping that I'd had before, such as tunnel digging, climbing over the wire, digging under the wire, that type of thing. Very few of those led anywhere. There was nobody, as far as I know, ever got out of Colditz by digging a tunnel. You know, this wasn't the way to get out of Colditz. But on the other hand, the very fact that one was engaged in something, if one had at least an inkling of a hope that it would be successful, well, it kept one occupied, and at the same time, one's approach to things was the general approach in Colditz. So those, I think, are the things that surprised me most.
I wonder if I could take up a few of the points that you've raised there. First of all, about the actual living conditions, you've described very clearly the lack of space and claustrophobia. Mm. But I've always imagined that being in Colditz must have been like being in a dark, dank, damp castle. Was this an accurate picture?
Well, no, I don't think it is. It depends how one imagines a damp, dark castle. Some years ago, I visited Dover Castle, for example, and went down to the underground place where they used to shut up the prisoners in days gone by. It was nothing compared with that. I suppose from the point of view of people who'd never experienced anything remotely approaching it, might have appeared that way. I wouldn't go so far as to say certain parts of it were dark and dank, but insofar as our living quarters were concerned, which were right upstairs in the top of the castle, and one went up to them on stone circular steps or stairs, no, they were rather spacious, and they had windows, albeit with iron bars at all the windows. And there was nothing dark and dank. The cells, the castle cells, yes, I suppose they were the only rooms, if you can call them rooms, in the castle that bore any resemblance to what you've described as dark and dank. And they were. Those cells had been had been in existence for perhaps up to 1,000 years. And they were dark. They were small, nothing but a little narrow slit high up the wall to give one light, although there was electric light in them. But otherwise, no. The courtyard itself, in winter, yes, it was very dark and very dank and very dreary. You know, there wasn't a glimmer, I suppose, of anything attractive about it. Particularly if when you look early in the war, it had on one wall, this is as you go in the entrance to the courtyard, the wall opposite was covered with Virginia creeper, which gave it a certain atmosphere. But the Virginia creeper died. I suppose we were responsible for it dying. And then you had nothing but bare walls with flaky paint and the windows, all of which had iron bars, strong iron bars on them. And all the doors were big, heavily studded doors. and the walls went up high. In itself, the courtyard, I suppose, was like a bear pit. In fact, that's about the closest comparison one can make to it. A small enclosure there with high walls all around it. But I suppose when one had arrived at Colditz, one was obviously in a vastly different position from somebody being plucked in from a normal life and suddenly shoved in there, because we'd been prisoners for some time and we got used to certain things. And so this was just one more step, rather than being plunged into it from a comfortable civilian life.
Why did you cause the death of the Virginia creeper?
Why? Well, I don't suppose it was done deliberately. It just died. You see, I have a photograph which I acquired, taken very early in the war, with the Poles, I think it is, playing netball in the courtyard. And the wall there is completely covered with a Virginia creeper, and it looks quite pleasant. Why it died, I just don't know, because you had hordes of chaps in there, and it may have been killed deliberately, or... God knows, I just don't know, but it did die.
You said that in Colditz the guards were remote, in a sense. But did you ever get to know anything about the guards personally, like their names or their family background?
Well, not names. We had nicknames for them. I'm trying to remember the nicknames for the guards. For example, the one of the guards, the first chap in fact who put a bullet through somebody, we knew him as Big Bum. What the hell his name was, I just don't know. We just knew him as Big Bum. Lieutenant Pupka was Vic Oliver. Now, what was Egger's nickname? I forget what Egger's nickname was, but we had nicknames for those members of the German staff whom we knew well, whom we saw often. We had nicknames for them. But no, one knew Pupka's surname, one knew Egger's surname, one knew the commandant's surname. But and Gephardt, he was Franz Joseph, simply because he looked like Franz Joseph. Franz Joseph sort of build, and he had damn great big moustaches which came right out here.
And presumably Pupka looked like Vic Oliver, the comedian.
Well, one thought he did, yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, he was... I never inquired into the origin of his nickname, but yes, now you come to mention it, yes, he did look something like Vic Oliver.
So, well, did the guard seem to be under orders not to get chatty with the POWs?
Oh, very much so. Oh, very much so. I mean, one could see that there were one or two of the chaps who got chummy, if that's the word, with the guards. For example, Checo, Kalupka, an RAF pilot officer. He was a Czech who cleared out of Czechoslovakia when the Germans marched in. From Czechoslovakia, he went to Poland. He was in the Czechoslovak Air Force. He went to Poland and joined the Polish Air Force, and when Poland was overcome, he made his way to France and joined the French Air Force, and when France capitulated, he came to England and joined the RAF. Now, Checo could speak fluent German, and not only that, he was a most charming chap, and Checo had that gift of expanding. He could talk to no matter who it was. He was, you might perhaps term him a con man, although that's an unfair expression. But Checo was one of the very, very few indeed who built up a relation. He had his pet guards, and it would all start very, very casually, but this was all a means to an end, and he'd get to know a guard. And the guards were, of course, changed from time to time, but some of them remained there, you know, perhaps for a year. He'd get to know a guard and build up a relationship, perhaps when we got cigarettes, offering him a cigarette or and so on, which the guard would refuse to start with. But it built up slowly, 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 with very, very innocent things. You know, when they'd had a few conversations, and all the time during these conversations, the guard was on the qui vive, and if another guard was looking, unless perhaps it was a chum of his, he'd stop the conversation, and if the door to the courtyard opened, immediately he'd stop the conversation and march off. But nevertheless, these contacts were established, and they're very important contacts because they built up little by little. And the first step might be in a conversation. For example, Checo would ask how things were for him and his family. And he might, for example, say, well, it's a bloody war, you know, we've all got to put up with it. One thing my wife misses, or my girlfriend misses, is she can't buy any decent soap, because the soap was made out of clay, you know, it was very rough stuff. You could wash with it, but it was awful bloody stuff, you know, not the sort of stuff that some pretty little filly would want to wash her face with. And after a certain time, perhaps, and this is what did happen, Checo, or whoever it may be, would slip him a bar of soap, because we got soap in our Red Cross parcels when they were coming in, and of course it was real soap, good quality stuff. And this is how it built up, until it got to a certain stage when the guard built up a relationship with Checo or whoever it was, and there was a certain amount of trust there, when whatever it was just perhaps a little more than a bar of soap. And once it got to that stage, well, then we got them. Because one of the biggest fears of the guards was to be sent off to the Ostfront, to the Russian front. And we used to stick notices up. They were torn down by the guards, and we had various punishments and withdrawal of privileges because of this. We used to stick various things up on the wall. For example, in this particular context was one, Posten, Posten, Gehr nach Osten, guard, guard, go off to the East Front. Of course, this meant something to them. It meant one hell of a bloody lot to them, you see, because they all knew what the East Front was like, and they knew that they were a damn sight better off where they were than on the Ostfront. And another one, too, and this was regarded very, very seriously indeed by the camp authorities. Sind Sie auf der Schwarzer Liste? And the Z would be heavily underlined. Sind Sie auf der Schwarzer Liste? Are you on the blacklist? And it got to the stage when it was evident, after Stalingrad or sometime like that, it got to the stage when it was evident that Germany couldn't win the war, when this really meant something to the guards, and you'd get guards asking if they were on the blacklist. And depending on the guards, the answer might be, well, I think you must wait till the end of the war, and then you'll find out whether you're on the blacklist or not. But there were a number of the guards, of course, on the blacklist. But this was all a form of blackmail, and an essential form of blackmail, because it built up to the stage when you could get, within reason, virtually anything you wanted from those particular guards, because they had just had to take the risk, because they knew bloody well that we'd only got to feed information to the camp authorities, and that was easy enough to do, and they'd be for the bloody high jump. You know, it wasn't only the fear of the East Front, of the Ostfront, but also fear of a court-martial and getting shot as a result of it, you see. So this became very real, and that's how we acquired all sorts of things from the Germans. I mean, virtually, within reason, virtually whatever we wanted was obtained that way. And that was because people like Checo had built up this relationship with a particular guard, and built it up to the point when it could threaten the guard. And there were very, very serious threats. And that's how we got a camera into which we needed for forged documents. How we got printing ink, in, how we got pens in, how we got in virtually whatever we wanted. So, but that was the only relationship with the guards. I don't remember a single occasion when there was any relationship with the guards such as the relationship that there was with a number of guards at Marlag. I can see various situations at Marlag. The guards coming in, for example, coming into our room, dumping their rifle against the wall, sitting down to a cup of tea, unbuttoning their jackets and so on, and having a discussion about all sorts of things.
With the POWs?
With the POWs, yes. I mean, we used to argue with them about various things. The chap I'm thinking of in particular at Marlag, whenever we put anything to him about the war, the way the war was going, the rights and wrongs of the war, his reply always started the same. Aber Hitler hat gesagt. Hitler hat gesagt. Hitler has said. And this was the Bible to him. You know, if Hitler said it, it was right. But there was never any relationship. Even the Saalmeister, who was a junior officer, the Saalmeister, and I had regular contacts with him because I was the records officer and the finance chap in Colditz for the prisoners. It was I who handled all the Lagergeld and so on, who kept the records and unofficial records as well as official records. And although I saw this chap regularly, he used to come in and we'd get together in the evidence Zimmer, never got on a anything remotely approaching a matey relationship. That sort of thing never occurred in Colditz.
You said that a guard put a bullet through one of the PRWs. Can you tell me how that came about?
Well, this was nothing unusual. This is nothing unusual. It was unusual. Bullets flying around weren't unusual. But yes, this was Mike Sinclair. You've obviously heard the name of Mike Sinclair. And I've mentioned Franz Josef, who was much about the same build as Mike Sinclair. And Mike Sinclair spent his whole time dreaming of escapes, conjuring up ways of getting out, and of course very successfully. He'd perhaps spend 6 months on a particular plan, studying every detail of it. For example, in this specific instance, the idea was to get down onto the catwalk, which was divided into sections. It was a narrow catwalk, well down from our living quarters, you know, perhaps 40 or 50 feet down from our living quarters, and perhaps 10, 12 feet wide. And on the other side of it, it had a low wall and barbed wire on top of it, and then a big drop, not a perpendicular drop, but a steeply sloping drop. Below that were bushes and more barbed wire, but beyond that were the back gardens of some houses. And Mike was a fluent German speaker, and his plan was to, first of all, to dress up as Franz Josef, and to do that our sewing maidens had to get to work. And we had quite a number who were dab hands at sewing. Rex Harrison, for example. Rex was a big chap, about 6'5". And he, before I was shifted into a cell, his bunk was above mine. We lived in three-tier bunks, and his was above mine, you see. And I can still see old Rex now in that bunk, but I can also see him sitting there, stitching away, stitching away, stitching away. And we had the Dutch with us at the time, and their uniforms, the material and the colour of the uniforms were virtually the same as the German uniforms. The cut of the uniform wasn't the same, but the cloth and the colour was much the same. So the starting point, obviously, was to get hold of a Dutch uniform, and the Dutch we had very close liaison with the Dutch, and in fact with all the nationalities there. We had a central escaping committee, as well as the individual nationalities having their own escape committees. So John Wotton made sketches of when Franz Joseph came into the courtyard, and he always came in with a damn great big bunch of keys hanging underneath his jacket. John Wotton made sketches of Franz Joseph, including everything, not only his appearance, his facial appearance, the angle at which he wore his cap, the various badges or whatever it was he wore on his uniform, the way he walked and so on and so on. And the uniforms were made. The ingenuity in the making of the uniforms was obviously very considerable. The papers had to be forged, of course, and the various stamps were made out of courtesine, the floor covering, thick brown type of linoleum. They were made out of that. Insofar as Franz Joseph was concerned, he carried the dirk or dagger that they all carried. This was carved out of wood. The holster, the thing it went into, was made out again out of courtesine. Revolver was made out of wood, and the holster made out of wood. You know, everything. The belts were made out of wood. The badges were made out of things were pinched from the fittings, lead or what have you. The Gottmittens belt badges, for example. So this was a pretty wide combination of workers of various skills, and the plan, and with there was another John Hyde Thompson. Another uniform was made for John as a German sentry. Now this scheme was first of all to cut the bars on the windows, and that would be a last minute job, and cut so that they could be replaced and look as if they hadn't been cut. But Mike was, and he'd spent months and months and months at the window, timing every move and getting to know the routine. The Germans are very routine conscious. You know, if a thing must be done in such and such a way at a specific time of the day, it is done at such and such a way at a specific time of the day. You know, this is the German mentality. So he'd got this down in detail, just how long it took them to patrol their particular piece of the catwalk, when the sentries changed over, what precisely they did, what time they changed over, and this was, you know, at various stages during the day, and particularly in the evening, after dark. He got this noted down in detail. And the scheme was, at the moment juste, the bars would be removed, the rope would be shoved out, Mike would climb down, the rope whipped up, and there would be Mike down on the catwalk. To all intents and purposes, he was Franz Joseph. And he would order the sentry back to the Kommandantur, for some reason or other, and take the sentry's keys, and would unlock the gate, because dividing each section of the catwalk, again coming across it like that, coming across it was another wire fence with a gate in it, a wire gate. He would unlock that and go through to the next section, relieve the chap there in the same way, send him back to the Kommandantur, and then relieve the chap on the bridge going over the moat, because there was a moat just a little way along there. Well, found the first chap, the first sentry, went marching back to the Kommandantur, and this would have been, say, 3/4 hour's job by the time he'd got back to the Kommandantur and found out what the hell he was wanted for. The second chap, fine, no problem whatsoever. And there we were up in the room behind the windows, listening. One chap trying to see what was going on, but this was difficult because you couldn't, because the bars had to be put back immediately. Mike was out, you see. And everything was going very, very well. And as we heard the rest of the story later, but Mike got the second chap back and went through that gate, and there he was left with the bridge over the moat. And beyond the bridge over the moat, well, there were virtually no defences. You know, there were defences that would be easy to get through, but the chap on this bridge, why, I don't know. was suspicious, or he was either suspicious or he was sticking precisely to regulations. And he asked Mike, or as Franz Josef, to produce his authority in precisely the same way. I mean, if you've seen films where perhaps at an RAF station in this country during the war, the commanding officer has come to the main gate, attempted to drive straight through, and a sentry has stopped him. And the commanding officer has said, "Well, you know who I am. I'm sorry, sir, but my orders are." You see, that's that sort of thing. And this chap asked Mike to show his pass, and Mike screamed at him as Feldwebel, as Feldwebel or Oberstabs Feldwebel Gebhard would. You know, this is the normal German way. Screamed at him, saying, "Well, whatever he said, in effect, you know who I am. You know, I'll have your guts for garters if you don't obey my orders." And this chap wouldn't have it. And Mike was there. We were listening to this. We were listening to Mike screaming at him in the way that so many German NCOs would scream.